For the last 8 years, I was a faculty member at the Santa Fe Institute. And for the previous 36 years, I was a professor at Boston University. And I got my PhD at MIT. I was an undergrad at UC Berkeley. And then I had the misfortune of going to high school in Canada. Anyway, the one thing is that I have no idea what you guys know and don't know, because this I taught in this program 14 years ago at once. And so, you know, it's been a while since I've been doing this. And it's also been 10 years since I've been in front of a classroom teaching, because there's no teaching at the Santa Fe Institute. My last 2 years at BU, I was department chairman, so I wasn't teaching then. So I hope I remember how to teach. The other thing is, you know, please do feel free to ask questions. I don't mind, you know, just, hey, you, just shout out, whatever. I'm not a terribly formal person, so please just feel free. So that's the introduction. Any questions before we get started? Okay, so this course is statistical physics. And when I was discussing with the staff here, like what to teach, you know, I was told that in previous years, there was a lot of emphasis on equilibrium statistical physics or normalization group and things of that nature. And what I told the Perimeter Institute is I thought that the students, you students, would be better served by having more of an emphasis on non-equilibrium processes, because this is what people who work in statistical physics are working on now. So more or less, I'd say 1/3 to 40% of the course will be on equilibrium, and the remainder will be on non-equilibrium processes. So it's going to be very different than I think what's happened in the past. So this first lecture, basically, I want to give a whirlwind tour of statistical physics, just so that we're on the same page. I'm kind of assuming that all of you have had like an undergraduate course in statistical physics. I hope that's the correct assumption. But you know, just to remind ourselves like what is statistical physics and what it's good for. So I'd like to just do a very brief recapitulation. So that's it. I'm going to begin at the beginning. So, and also tell me if I'm writing too small, because I tend to do that. So the first thing I want to talk about is the Boltzmann distribution. And how do we derive it? And I tend to like the absolute simplest, maybe sleaziest way of deriving things. So like I try to avoid lots of mathematical details. So here is the simplest way that I'm aware of for deriving this, which is that you imagine there's the universe, and you want to understand what is the probability that a given system has an energy E. But what do we call our system? We can call it anything we want. So let us define our system to be one quantum energy level. So here is our system, one quantum energy level. So there's our system. And it's in thermal contact with the rest of the universe. And so I'll call that the reservoir. And so this guy has an energy E system. And since the end, you know, okay, forgetting about cosmology or anything like that, I'm going to assume that the energy of the rest of the universe is fixed. And so the energy of the reservoir is going to be the energy of the entire universe minus E system. That's its energy. And so the probability that the system has an energy E system. So let me not have multiple subscripts. So this is going to be proportional to. So again, if I have my quantum system in contact, thermal contact with the reservoir. So the reservoir has many degrees of freedom. And so the probability that I have a given energy ES in the system is proportional to the number of ways that you can arrange the states of the reservoir, given that it has the rest of the energy of the universe. So this is going to be proportional to capital omega. So omega is the canonical notation for number of states of the system at energy E minus ES. So that's how we're going to calculate the probability distribution of our system. Now, already here at this very first step comes something very important. This number, you know, the number of nucleons in the universe is 10 to the 80, and so the number of states is going to be like exponential of 10 to the 80. This is a humongous number. This is a tiny variation on the total energy in the universe. So you'd be tempted to do a Taylor series expansion of this thing. But when you're dealing with numbers which are like e to the 10 to the 80, you can't do a Taylor series. And so what we need to do, first of all, is we have to deal with numbers that are kind of more rational. And so what we do is we look at logarithm of P of ES. Let's see, that's proportional to logarithm omega of E minus ES. And now this, you know, like it seems like I've done nothing, but at this stage, it's now permissible to do a Taylor series expansion. And this is kind of underlies all of asymptotic analysis. And so there's a lot of mathematics that goes from going from this step to doing a Taylor series expansion here that I'm sweeping under the rug. But just beware that oftentimes when you're dealing with thermodynamics, we always deal with logarithm of probabilities, or logarithm of the number of states, not the number of states itself. And so here, I'll now do a Taylor series expansion. And so this is going to be equal to, so the zeroth term is just logarithm of the number of states at the energy of the universe, which is some fixed number. So I'll call it A. And then I have minus d by dE, d by dE of log of omega times ES. And this, so now I'm going to take a definition that one learns from thermodynamics, and I'll have more to say about it later on, but let me just take it as a definition. Logger than the number of states of the system is K times the entropy of the system. And so this is nothing more than one over K, the entropy of the system. So there's ES over K, and then I have dS by dE. So this is, I've swept something under the rug, but I hope you're not so surprised to know that the logarithm number of states K times the logarithm number of states is defined as the entropy of the system. So I have the entropy, the energy, and this thing is just the temperature. And so this,
yeah. Is the choice of logarithm only for convenience?
No, the choice of the logarithm is so that I can actually do the
big number. You're saying you're doing Taylor expansion, but you can't do the Taylor expansion for big numbers. What is wrong with that?
Well, no, I mean, the thing is that this function is so rapidly varying with energy that if you do the Taylor series expansion, you know, normally you'd say when you do Taylor series, like you want the coefficients to be not very big. And so, but in this case, the coefficients will be so big that the radius of convergence of the Taylor series is so small that it's not useful.
And you're saying you're sweeping stuff under the rug a lot. I don't understand. For example, this is just a definition. What did you sweep under the rug?
Well, it's just, you know, like if you had not seen this before, you'd say, like, what is this? And so I'm sort of assuming you know this. Yeah. Anyway, so here we are. So this is now going to be A minus. And so this is 1 over KT. All of this is equal to 1 over KT. And this, we give all of the notation beta. So this is going to be minus beta ES. So finally, we have our result, which is I can now re-exponentiate, and then I get P of ES is proportional to E to the minus beta ES. And so this is the Boltzmann factor. And this is like one of the standard, you know, this is one of the most useful results in all of classical statistical mechanics, which is what is the probability the system is in some energy state? It's proportional to e to the minus beta, that energy. Okay. So next point is that, so let's see what I say here. Yeah, so this thing. So now P of ES, so let me just give this maybe a title, partition function. So the point is that here, I only have a proportionality constant. So in order to make this inequality, I need some normalization. And so if I sum up over all possible states of the system, the probability that a system is in any given state has to add up to 1. So what I can say here is that the probability of actually being in an energy state ES is equal to e to the minus beta ES divided by summation over all states of the system. And I'll write that sort of with a curly bracket to denote that these are like sums over many different sets of quantum numbers, e to the minus beta ES. And this I'll define as e to the minus beta es divided by z. And so this thing is called the partition function. And if you solve for the partition function of a statistical physics system, that's considered you've solved the problem. So in all kinds of situations, solving for the partition function is the holy grail of solving a many-body problem. Okay. So let me just add to this thing. Let's call this N free energy. Because as we're going to see, the partition function is directly related to something called the Helmholtz free energy, which turns out to be a Legendre transform of the energy. And it's one of the basic thermodynamic potentials from which, you know, we can calculate all kinds of physical properties of any system. Okay. So let me see if I can work this now. Front. Wow. Can you guys still see that up there? Okay. Is it too high? A little high? Okay. But how about we keep put it here?
It's good.
Okay, good. All right. Middle. Okay. So what I want to do now is from this expression for the part, I can't see it. It's like I'll see reflection. All right. So we have z is equal to summation over all states of the system, e to the minus beta e system. There's another way we can write this, which is instead of looking at all different quantum states and summing over each individual state, we can kind of adopt the approach of like solid state physics, which is that you sum not over individual quantum states, but over energies. And so I could write this as a summation over energies, energy levels, omega of E. So this is the number of states at energy E times E to the minus beta E. And now let me drop the subscript S because we're summing over like all possible energies of the system. And so this I can then write as summation over the energies, E to the minus beta E plus log omega of E. So this is the number of states at energy E. And it's sort of related to the capital omega here, which is the total number of states of the universe. And typically, since we're dealing with like a thermodynamic system, which has got a macroscopic number of particles, the number of states at a particular energy, and this capital omega, which is normally defined as the number of states of all energies up to energy E, these things are like, one is like the surface area of a high-dimensional sphere, one is the volume of a high-dimensional sphere, but in very high dimensions, the surface area and the volume are essentially the same thing. And so this is, again, nothing more than related to the entropy. So this thing I can write as summation, let me make a better summation sign, summation over energies, E to the beta energy, and then I have plus. And so this is going to be, so again, to define the entropy, we have to take log of the number of states. And so this is going to be 1 over k times the entropy.
Wait, sorry, would you mind saying again which is related to the surface area and which is?
Yeah, so this thing is the number of states at energy E. And if I think about like a classical mechanical system, you know, I have like, the number of ways I can arrange my particles such that it has a total energy E. So in a six n dimensional phase space, this thing is proportional to the number of states on the energy surface.
Oh, okay.
And this is like the total number that's like in the entire volume. But the thing is that when n is large, 10 to the 23, the volume of a 10 to the 23 dimensional sphere and the surface area are basically the same thing, up to like really small corrections. Okay. So the thing is that this guy, and I'm going to be a little bit more precise about this in a moment. So notice here that as a function, the sum and, so as e gets larger, this term gets smaller. As e gets larger, this term gets bigger. So there's two competing terms in the sum and. And so let me just postulate, and then I'll derive it momentarily, that this is dominated by the largest term in the sum. And in the thermodynamic limit, it truly is dominated by the largest term in the sum up to logarithmic correction. So if we take the largest term in the sum, then this thing will scale as e to the minus beta. And now let me use u for the average energy, or like the or the energy that maximizes the, it's the maximizing energy in the sum, plus, and so let me do this now, a minus, and this is going to be Ts. And this guy, this e to the minus beta, free energy. So this guy is called the Helmholtz, I guess he has a capital, Helmholtz free energy.
Sorry, what was u and ts?
So u was the one, so when I'm saying this thing is approximately equal to the largest term in the sum, and so the value of the energy where it maximizes the sum is what I'm calling u. And this, as we're going to see in a moment, is related to the, it's like the average thermodynamic energy of some macroscopic system. Okay, so now what the heck is this Helmholtz free energy? And so let me just mention that the way that we can sort of get some feeling for what this thing is let's again look at, so let's return to our original system, which is our reservoir and our system. So reservoir, system. And the thing is that, you know, we learn in like the most elementary thermodynamics when we're doing what's called the microcanonical ensemble, where we fix the energy of the system, that what the system does is it maximizes the number of states available to it. And so we want to maximize the total number of states available to the system. And again, this is proportional to the number of states of the reservoir times the number of states of the system. And once again, we don't deal with these things, we deal with the logarithm. So we're going to maximize logarithm omega total, which is equal to logarithm omega reservoir at energy E minus E system plus logarithm of the system, the number of states of the system. And then again, I'm just going to do the same thing as before. I'm going to write this this in a Taylor series. So this is going to be minus beta ES. And this guy is 1 over k, the number of ways available to the system. So now I'm here again as a bit of a cheat, which is that instead of saying that I have just one quantum state, I now have like some small system, like a million atoms, and I have the number of states available to this small system. And so this is going to be just the entropy of the system. And so if I just turn this around a little bit, so this is
equal. Not a one-state system?
No. So I just said I'm again being a little bit fluid in what I'm calling my system, because I can call it anything. So here, my system was one quantum level. Now I'm imagining that my system is something, let's say, a million particles. Doesn't matter, as long as it's much smaller than the size of the reservoir. And so now logarithm of the, so in this, when I had only one state, one quantum state, there's only one possible state of the system. But if I have a million particles, there's many states that the system can be in. And so the logarithm number of states is just the entropy. Okay, and so this is equal to A minus beta E minus TS. And on the left-hand side, I had logarithm, the total number of states of the system. So this I'll write as A minus beta. And so this again is my Helmholtz free energy. So the point here is that if I want to maximize the total number of states of the system, which is a normal thing you do in the microcanonical ensemble, that's the same as minimizing the free energy. So maximize the total number of states of the system is equivalent to minimizing the Helmholtz free energy F. And so oftentimes in a statistical mechanics course, you learn that, you know, the free energy is the thing which is minimized. And one more thing I just want to mention about the free energy, which is that when I was taking undergraduate stat mech and I first heard the term Helmholtz free energy, I thought of like a stuffy old guy with a, you know, 1890 suit, and, you know, they're smoking cigars and discussing free energies and what this is. But what the heck is a Helmholtz free energy? Why is it called the free energy? Why is it free? What's going on? And so it turns out, and again, this is a nice exercise you can do for any kind of a thermodynamic system, is that if you have like a reservoir, like a heat, you know, a bunch of heat, how much energy can you extract out of it? And so you probably have learned about the Carnot cycle and the fact that, you know, you can convert heat to work, but there's also some exhaust, and that's like a penalty you have to pay. And the total amount of energy that you can translate from heat into work is exactly the Helmholtz free energy. So that's why it's called the free energy. It's the energy which is free for you to actually exploit, and some of it you have to actually waste by exhaust. Okay, so I guess that's all I want to say about this little story here. All right, let me now just turn a little bit more mathematically to the role of energy fluctuations. Because we've seen in going over here that I said, oh, here's the partition function. You sum over states, you sum over energies. There's an infinite number of terms in the sum. And they said, let's just keep one term in the sum, the maximizing term. And you might fairly say, like, how can you do that? Like, you know, there's lots of terms in the sum. What about the rest of the terms in the sum? What I want to show now is if you keep all the terms in the sum, you will get the same thing modulo logarithmic corrections. And so this is why thermodynamics actually works. When n is of the order of 10 to the 23, when you exponentiate it, you have e to the 10 to the 23. And when you're doing the summation, the largest term in the sum is so much bigger than anything else that the contribution of everything else is negligible compared to the biggest term in the sum. This is like an important lesson in thermodynamics, that it works because n is so large. So if we were like all like 10 to the 20 times smaller, we would not have thermodynamics as we know it, because fluctuations would actually be a dominant contribution to the physical properties of any system. Okay, so again, let's go to our partition function Z, which is equal to summation over states, e to the minus beta energy, let state. And then I'm going to write this as summation over energies, omega V, e to the minus beta e. And so now I'm going to drop the subscript s, because this is like my summation index itself is the energy. And so this is the number of states at energy e. Okay. And then I'm going to write this as, so I'm going to do two steps here. One is I'll put this in the exponent. Second thing, I'm going to convert the sum to an integral. And again, if I have like, you know, I think of my energy levels as microscopically spaced, it's permissible to convert the sum to an integral. And so this is going to be integral from 0 to infinity, dE, e to the minus beta e plus k log s as a function of energy. And again, that's what I had over here. Okay. And pardon me?
Wasn't it log omega, which means 1 over ks?
Oh, is it, did I have it upside down? Beta e plus log omega. Okay. Let me just write this as log omega of e. Okay. All right. So let me write this 0 to infinity. So this is something you have to watch out for me. I'm really bad at like 1 over, you know, I have a bit of dyslexia, so just watch out for me. So I'll write this as e to the, and so let's write this in the following way. So log of omega is, again, this is s over k. I guess I got that right. Yes. And so let me write this as, okay, let me write as beta. And so here we have, so beta is 1 over kt, so I have to have t times log of, so the ts minus e. Okay, I think I got that correct. Very good. Okay, so the thing is that for those of you who have had like a course in mathematical physics where you do the Laplace method, when you have an integral of something where the exponent, you know, this is like e to something, everything is proportional to n. So you have e to the n times some function of, you know, some function of little of the energy per particle. So the way that one does integrals of this type is that one expands it about the maximum, and one gets one does a second order approximation. So one is left with the Gaussian integral, which one does, and we're going to see that the largest term in this the term which maximizes this was what we had over here, and then the effect of the Gaussian integral is to give rise to only a logarithmic correction. So let me call the exponent function g of e. So that's equal to beta, and then I have ts minus e. So what I'm going to do is, first of all, compute g prime of e. And that's derivative with respect to energy. So that's going to be beta t ds dE minus 1. But we've seen that ds dE is the definition of the inverse temperature. And in fact, now we have to be a little bit careful, because this is at any old value of the energy. This thing, ds dE, this thing is equal to 1 over t when e is equal to e max. Because we want to set this thing equal to 0 to look for the maximum of the exponent. And so when we set it equal to 0, we're looking at where e is equal to e max. And that at that point, this is equal to 1 over the temperature. And this e max is what I'm also going to define as the average energy of the system, because as we're going to see that the maximizing term and the average energy are basically the same thing. You were about to ask a question.
Why isn't T E dependent? Temperature, is that the temperature of the reservoir, and E is the energy of the system? That's why you didn't take the differentiation?
No, the thing is that, I mean, where the energy dependence is the, again, let me be a little bit more explicit here. This is T S of E minus.
The temperature is not energy dependent, because you're saying that your system is attached to a very big reservoir and your temperature is constant with respect to.
No, no, but you know, again, the thing is that the temperature is defined as precisely, you know, so let me just put over here 1 over the temperature is equal to ds dE, and the energy is equal to the average energy of the system. So it's not a free running variable here. Okay, so anyways, so the first point is that when we're looking for the maximum of this quantity, setting this thing equal to 0, we verify what we know, which is that this thing is actually equal to 0. And then let's look at g double prime of e. So this is equal to beta t, and then I have a d by dE of 1 over t. And then there's nothing here. And so this I can write as minus beta over t. And then I have d by dE. Ugh. Yeah, so this is d by dE of t. And this minus beta over t. Whoops. No, I guess this is right. So what is dt by dE? So I argue that, well, dt by dE is just 1 over dE by dt. And what is dE by dt? That's the change in energy of a system when I change a temperature. And this is nothing more than the heat capacity of the system. So this thing is 1 over CV.
Wait, sorry, I'm a little confused. Here we're taking a derivative with respect to energy of
right.
temperature. But in the line above, we didn't take the g prime of e, we didn't take a derivative of temperature with respect to energy. How come it kind of turns into a variable? or function of energy in G double prime, but it wasn't a function of energy in G prime?
Good question. I don't know off the top of my head. Okay, so I did something which is, you know, too sloppy here for my own good, I think, which is, okay, so let me back up a second. So this is equal to, so first of all, beta is 1 over kT. So this is 1 over k. God, this chalk is wimpy. This is 1 over k. And then I have ds by dE minus 1. Minus beta. Okay, and so this again we is equal to zero. But the point is that this looks like there's a temperature here, but there isn't a temperature here. This I should write as just 1 over k.
Okay, so now I have a problem with the definition.
Hang on a second. 1 over kT squared. Yes. Okay. Ask away.
The problem. Definition of temperature. You said your temperature is 1 over temperature is ds dE when E is equal to the
right
energy of the system, but here you're saying T is E dependent because you're taking the derivative with respect to E.
Well, no, but the thing is that, again, you know, this is a general function of E. I now differentiate it. This is a general function of E. So this I should write as maybe T of E. But then the point here is that when E is equal to E max, this thing 1 over T of E just turns into the real physical temperature of the system. But, you know, here I'm just doing the derivative and I'm going to evaluate it. You know, you have to do the order correctly. You have to first differentiate it and then set E equal to the average energy.
So that T that you wrote there is the actual temperature of the system.
Yes.
The T that you wrote here for ds dE. That's just a symbol.
Where are we? What, this thing here?
You said dsd is equal to 1 over t, but, and you use that.
Okay. So again, all right. So let me just rewrite. So again, this is 1 over k ds by dE minus beta. And now the question is, what is this object here? So for at arbitrary energy, it's something. But when the energy is equal to the average energy of the system, this turns into the thermodynamic temperature.
So this TE that is written here is not that T, but it turns into that T when the E is equal to U.
Exactly so. Yes?
So are you defined at E max or E average, or is there some way?
Well, so the point is that, again, in the thermodynamic limit, you know, you see the thing is that this integrand has a maximum somewhere. And the point is that where the maximum has, where the maximum occurs is coincides with the average energy, they're the same thing up to tiny logarithmic correction. So that's why I'm being sloppy about average energy or the maximizing energy. They're all the same thing in the thermodynamic limit.
I'm sorry, I'm a bit confused.
No, fire away.
Okay, so in the G prime case, right, we've got a beta, you know, like the times negative 1 turns into minus beta, but that's dependent on T still, and we're not taking a derivative of energy with respect to that T. And I'm not entirely sure why.
Okay. You know, I think maybe I've messed something up. I'm not sure what. You know, look, I guess the way to finesse all of this is let's define beta this, get this guy here. That's going to make life a lot simpler.
1 over beta that?
No, because I want this thing, I'm going to define this thing as E to the beta G of E. And G of E, by construction, is TS minus E.
So beta.
What?
So no beta. Left-hand side, just G of E is equal to that.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Okay. So now I think now there should be no bullshit, I believe.
Well, wait, but then that doesn't get rid of the T.
Doesn't get rid of the T.
The beta was what got rid of that T.
Right.
Yes. And yeah. That's why. But now the t is there, and we have to take the derivative with respect to t. Oh no! Oh no!
I don't know what to tell you. I mean, the thing is that, look, I guess what I would say is the following, is that we have to differentiate things which are functions of the energy. So this entropy is a function of the energy. This is some parameter, which I don't know what it is yet. But I do know that when I take ds by dE and evaluate it at the maximizing energy, that it magically turns into 1 over the thermodynamic temperature. So here, when I'm differentiating, I differentiate things that are functions of energy only. And so that's why I can do what I've done here. And so again, in this part here, now I guess what I would say is let's to maybe make things a little bit, so I would say this is going to be d second s dE squared. That's what I want to compute. And so then here and only here, then this, you know, this, so this thing was 1 over k d by dE, and then this is 1 over t, and then I end up with this. So I don't think this is as clear as it should be, but I hope that, you know, I think the final result is correct. And so let me take this under advisement, and maybe if I have a better way of explaining it, I'll come back to it, say something about it next time.
I think there are two different temperatures that are based here.
Right. No, but the thing is that if they're in thermodynamic equilibrium, they're at the same temperature. That's the definition of thermodynamic equilibrium, that the reservoir and the system are at the same temperature.
It is the same.
Say it again?
The first derivative of the G prime tells us that the temperature between system and reservoir is the same.
Right.
So in that case, the beta is fixed constant if the reservoirs are huge.
Okay.
So we don't have to differentiate the beta. And also that T is the temperature of the reservoir. So.
Okay. Thank you. All right. So, you know, again, I think that this is not terribly, I mean, it's, in my mind, it's not terribly clear either, but so I apologize for a little bit of mess up here, but let's accept this for now, and let me try to be clear about it next time. But anyway, let's just proceed, and we'll deal with the fallout next time. So anyways, so finally, we have z is equal to the integral from 0 to infinity, and so I have e to the beta, and then it's going to be times g of 0, plus e minus u g prime of e at e equals u, and then I have plus 1/2 e minus u squared g prime of e, again evaluated when e is equal to u. So I'm just changing like this integral into a Gaussian integral, because the first term is a constant. This term is equal to 0, and this gives me a Gaussian integral, and that's what I'm going to compute here. And so what I'm going to get here is, so this is going to be e to the beta g of 0, and then here when I'm integrating this from 0, so I in the usual way, when you have an integral in which the maximizing point is somewhere in the range of the integral, I change the limits of the integration from 0 to infinity to minus infinity to infinity. And then this turns out to be the square root of 2 pi divided by g double prime of e.
Oh, sorry, I missed it while I was writing it down.
Sure.
Can you say again why we canceled out this middle term?
Because I'm evaluating this when e is equal to e max and u, and so the first derivative is equal to 0. Again, I'm just doing the typical thing. I have an integration of some exponential function, and this is a function which, this is increasing with energy, this is decreasing with energy. Somewhere there's a maximum, where the maximum is where it's the dominant term in the integral. And everything else gives me this Gaussian integral. When I evaluate it, I get this. And so what is this, all of this now? So this is e to the beta. And so g at, I'm sorry, this is at e, not 0. This is at, shoot, sorry. This is at e equals u. E equals u, the maximizing value. And so this is going to be T S minus U.
Do we evaluate the last part of the exponential at E equals U as well?
Yes.
But then doesn't that become 0 if we have
no
U squared?
No.
It's g double prime.
No, it's g double prime.
Yeah, but we're multiplying it by e minus u squared.
Yeah.
It doesn't. Oh, we're just evaluating e double prime. Anyway.
Right.
Okay.
Right, and that's what I'm just doing here. And so this thing is equal to times, and so this is going to be the square root, and so we're going to get 2 pi.
What was the first derivative zero?
That's the definition of evaluating the integral at the maximum point. So, does that answer your question or not?
Yeah, yes.
Okay. Anyway, so 2 pi, and this is kt squared cv. So that's the result. And I apologize for the screw-ups along the way. But notice what we have here. You know, S is like proportional to the size of the system. U is proportional to the size of the system. This is order e to the n. The heat capacity is proportional to the size of the system. So this is proportional to order root n. And so this is entirely negligible compared to all of this thing. So again, e to the 10 to the 23 is a pretty huge number. This is 10 square root of 10 to the 23, so it's like 10 to the 7th. So that seems like pretty huge, 10 million. But compared to e to the 10 to the 23, forget about it. So basically, this means that all this part, which is the effect of fluctuations, is negligible compared to the main part. And so this really sloppy thing I did over here, just saying I replace the sum by the largest term, is perfectly kosher. So it's just it's another way of justifying why, in a limit of n going to infinity, we can forget about fluctuations, and that's why we can always deal just with averages. And so in the past 20 years, you may have heard the name Chris Jarzynski, who became justifiably famous about worrying about the thermodynamics of small systems, where fluctuations do play an important role, and that's a whole new field that's very vibrant at the time, but very vibrant now. Okay, so that's all I wanted to say about this. Front. Okay. So let me just mention now connection of partition function with thermodynamics. So, in your very first thermodynamics course, you learn that you have like an isolated system. It has, you fix the energy, you fix the volume. Typically, you think about a gas. And you ask, like, for what is the entropy of the system? So normally we have S, which is a function of the energy and the volume. And from this, we can turn this around and write the energy as a function of S and V. So this is meant to be the average energy of a system, and it's a function of its entropy and its volume. And if you now apply some change to the system, you either squeeze it or heat it or do something to it, you do work on the system. And the fundamental thermodynamic identity or conservation of energy is that dU, the change in energy of a thermodynamic system, is a sum of two pieces if you're not changing the number of particles in the system. There is the heat added, plus the work done on the system. So I turn on a Bunsen burner, I heat some volume of gas, I squish it, I do something to it. Both of these things will increase the energy of the system. And what is this thing? This is TdS, and this minus PdV. And notice the minus sign, because if you squeeze a system, you're doing work on it, and therefore the work done has minus PdV. So if dV is negative, you'll do positive work. So that's something that that's a basic thermodynamic identity. And so from this, we can also write this as d du ds, keeping the other variable constant, ds plus du dv, keeping the other variable constant, so that's s dv. And so from this, we can identify that this is what we call temperature, and this is equal to minus P. So that's sort of like the microcanonical ensemble. So one thing that we learn early on is that it's not very easy to control the entropy of a system. Like, what is it? You know, you don't have an entropy meter, but what it is convenient to do is to control the temperature of the system. And so the Helmholtz free energy by the way, can you see this? Because I can barely see this. You can't see that. Is that better?
Yeah.
So I define F is equal to U minus TS. And again, this is what's called the Legendre transform. And there's a whole series of Legendre transforms that allows you to go between all different kinds of thermodynamic potentials. But let's just do this one. F is U minus TS. And so if I compute the differential of F, so this is equal to du minus T dS minus S dT. But given sort of the previous definition, the T dS cancels. And then I'm just left with minus P dV minus S dT, capital S. And so what we infer from this is that tells me that the natural variables of the free energy, Helmholtz free energy, are functions of T and V. Whereas.
Oh, never mind. Okay, we're good.
Okay. So whereas here, U is a function of S and V. V is a natural variable that you might be able to control. Maybe, maybe not. But S is something that we don't know how to control easily. But here, this is a much more natural set of variables. And furthermore, then we can identify that now that we know what the F depends on, so this is also the same as dF dV dV at constant temperature dV plus dF by dt at constant volume dt. And so that identifies that S is this guy and P is that guy. Okay. And so this is modulo mistakes, my whirlwind tour of basic thermodynamics and statistical physics. So, yeah.
In thermodynamics, when we write functions, state functions, in terms of some variables, and then we invert that expression to get S of UV equals U of SV.
Right.
Do we ever worry about if the functions are invertible or not, or does that matter at all?
In the instances we're going to ever deal with, they're always invertible. So that's not a worry.
Is there a physical reason why that is the case?
Well, I mean, it's just that, like, typically these are very simple functions. They're exponentials, logarithms, power laws. They're all invertible. Anything else? So I thought maybe it's worthwhile to take maybe a 2-minute break. I shut up and you can stretch or ask another question, but just let's break for 2 minutes and I'll start again in 2 minutes. Yes. But we can ask questions.
So in your definition of partition function, you have z is equal to the summation of e to the minus beta e.
Right.
And if you were to write your beta in terms of z and e, it gives you a logarithm of z over the summation of your logarithm of e's, I think. Minus that. Beta is in terms of the summation of all of your energy states and your partition function, isn't it?
I mean, I think you're making this more complicated than it needs to be. I mean, just
my
I think
write beta in terms of z and e's.
Okay.
Because I want to see why d beta de went to zero.
But I mean, I think what you should do is at least at this formula, you should treat this, just treat this as like a parameter.
Yeah.
I mean, the beta should not be a function. You know, like you shouldn't, you know, you shouldn't take. I mean,
no, because, assuming the beta in that formula is not also, which might not be right, energy dependent. So beta is constant for all of the energies of the system for different states of. Is it true?
That's independent.
If it is true, so d beta de could go to zero. Because
No. But first of all, I mean, look. The thing is that
t is temperature of the system, and that beta is temperature of the
reservoir. But they're both the same thing.
At the equilibrium.
At the equilibrium. So the first equation tells us they're the same.
I mean, the thing is that if you go back to like how we define the temperature, you normally you define the temperature definition, like the temperature wherever it was. You know, it's one over
the exact summation there. When we want to try the role of energy fluctuations,
yeah, so this beta is temperature of the reservoir. And the temperature of the reservoir is fixed.
So if it is the temperature of the reservoir, yes, it's, so the derivative, that's not exactly what you were saying.
It's not a function of the energy of the system. So when
we do the derivative, it's not if your system is infinitesimally small because the energy of your system can't.
No, I think you've saved me. You've told me the right answer, which is that in all of this, when we're talking about a reservoir and a system, the reservoir is so huge that if I add energy to it or take away energy to it, its temperature doesn't change. So I think that's. That sort of addresses all this mess up over here.
But then how come we can go and try to do dt de? Like, what is...
But the thing is that,
Why is the temperature of the system changing?
Because now we're working at g prime of t equals zero.
But if it's connected with the reservoir, it shouldn't change. It should always be...
Yeah, so the thing is that, you know, one should treat this thingy here, I mean, this is second derivative of the entropy with respect to the energy. And, you know, that's all there is to it. I mean,
because we're studying the fluctuations of the temperature.
Whoops. Yeah, go ahead.
The temperature of the system is fluctuating.
Mm-hmm.
So that beta there that you wrote there is the temperature of the reservoir, which is not changing because it's too big.
Right.
But the temperature that is defined by dSdE, which at equilibrium is equal to the temperature of the system, reservoir, is changing with respect to the energy of the system.
I'm not understanding.
All right. I think I'm going to punt right now, and I'll try and answer your question in a complete way next time. Yes. Yes.
If we never talk about numbers and evaluate everything, and in the end say that in the equilibrium, like when j prime is defined, that dSd is 1 over d,
mm-hmm.
In the end, if we substitute, we just get the same.
Okay. All right. You know, again, I will look at this myself, and I hope I will answer this unambiguously next time. Okay. So let me pick up again, because you know all of this formal stuff is like it's actually as you can see it's hard for me. I don't like formalism. I like to work with specific examples. So I want to now work a specific example of an ideal system, the two-state paramagnet, just to try and illustrate like. How you calculate the partition function, what you learn from the partition function, understanding the physical properties of an ideal system. And so my example now is the two-state paramagnet. So let's see, let's put this one far away. Well, hopefully we don't need this anymore. Okay, so example. Two-state paramagnet. So what is a paramagnet? A paramagnet is, you imagine that you have like some atom and it has a magnetic electron, like iron, and we just postulate that there are two possible states. There is spin up and spin down. And there's also a magnetic field, H, which is pointing up. And we postulate up that the energy is proportional to the magnitude of the spin times the magnitude of the magnetic field times the dot product between them. But if the spin only has two spin states, spin up and spin down, so here the energy of the spin up state is going to be equal to minus, because it's pointing in the same direction, and so it's negative energy. And so mu, which is the magnetic moment of my spin, times the magnetic field, and E spin down is equal to plus mu H. So the probability of having a spin up, E up, is proportional to E to the minus the beta energy, and so this is beta. And since it's the energy, it's minus the energy, but there's a minus sign here, it's plus, so it's E to the beta mu H. And similarly, P down is equal to E to the minus beta mu H. Since there's only two states of the system, the partition function, Z, and let me call it Z sub 1 because it's a partition function for one atom, one magnetic moment, so that's equal to E to the beta mu H plus E to the minus beta mu H, and that's equal to twice cosh beta mu H. So in particular, that says that P up is equal to E to the beta mu H divided by 2 cosh beta mu H, and P down is equal to E to the minus beta mu H divided by 2 cosh beta mu H. And so finally, one of the observables one might be interested in, which is what is the average spin at some temperature T? So the temperature is very high, lots of thermal agitation, and then this magnetic field is saying point up, but thermal agitation is saying, you know, point in any direction you want. Well, that wins out. There'll be no magnetic moment. But if the temperature is really low, then it's the magnetic field that dominates, and so we should expect that the spin should align with the magnetic field. And so let's now compute the average magnetization. And because there's only two states in the system, it's very simple. It's going to be the probability up times the magnetic moment minus the probability pointing down times its magnetic moment, which is pointing down, divided by the partition function. So this is going to be mu e to the beta mu h divided by 2 cosh beta mu h, and then minus e to the minus beta mu h divided by 2 cosh beta mu h. And this to me looks like mu hyperbolic tanh of beta mu H. So that's the average magnetization. So that's important result number one. This shows how the magnetization varies with both the temperature and the magnetic field. And if we plot magnetization as a function of beta mu H, that's the natural variable combination system. Notice it's dimensionless. Mu H is an energy. Beta is 1 over kT, which is an energy. So this is a dimensionless parameter. And always when you're trying to understand the properties of a physical system, it's very nice to try and find the right dimensionless groupings. And so here, this is the natural dimensionless grouping. And here is the average magnetization. And so we're plotting it as a function of magnetic field. And so it saturates at plus mu and minus mu. And so way out here where H is much larger, or mu H is much larger than beta, and again, beta is 1 over the temperature, and so you have to sometimes think backwards, because like beta small is temperature is high. So when beta is large, that means the temperature is small. So when either the temperature is small or the magnetic field is very strong, the spin is going to align with the magnetic field. So out here, it saturates, and out here it saturates. And then for small values of the combination beta mu h, it's going to eventually do something like this and come in linearly and do something like that. And so where the where this happens, where the magnetization starts to deviate from saturation, is like where beta mu h is of the order of 1. And so that somehow is measuring there's no phase transition here because the system is always magnetized except in zero magnetic field. But it's sort of saying when the magnetization changes from being close to saturation value to being small. And so that's the natural parameter of the system. Okay. One more thing that we might be interested in. Let's see. Bring this up here. And this here. I've never had such beautiful blackboards before. I was always erasing. Okay, so first of all, let's make this a little higher. So we have Z1. Can you see here? Okay. Z1, which is equal to 2 cosh beta mu h. Zn, the partition function of n independent spins. Well, if they're not interacting with each other, then the partition function of n of them is just the partition function of 1 raised to the nth power. So this is equal to 2. So let's just write it as z1 to the power n. And then the free energy we know is minus kt log z. But log z, since it's z to the n, so I can write this as ktn log of 2. So it's logarithm of z1. So this log 2 cosh beta mu h. So that's the partition. That's the partition function and free energy of an n particle system. And so given f, then we can find, and remember now, df, well, that was equal to minus s dt minus, for a gaseous system, we had minus pdv, and the analog for a magnetic system is mdh. So this capital M here is now the magnetization of n particles, whereas I had little m for the magnetization of a single particle. So dm is we can find by minus df dh, and we're just going to get that. But let's now look at the entropy of the system. So m is equal to minus df by dh, and that we already know. So that's going to be n mu hyperbolic tanh beta mu h. And the entropy, so that's equal to minus df dt. And again, to be really kosher, I should put here this is df dh at constant temperature. This is df dt at constant magnetic field. And so this, because I always get this wrong, let me just write out the answer. So it's nk log 2 cosh beta mu h minus nk beta mu h tanh beta mu h. And so let's look at the behavior of the entropy. I'm going to kill all the chalk here. Entropy, again, is a function of this natural parameter grouping beta mu h. And so first of all, when beta mu h goes to 0, this is cosh. Cosh of 0 is 1. This goes to nk log 2. Tanh of 0 is 0, so this goes away. So at beta going to 0, which is infinite temperature or zero magnetic field, all spin states are equally likely to occur. So each spin has 2 possible states. So n spins has 2 to the n possible states. So the entropy should just be logarithm of 2 to the n, which is 2 log n. I mean, n log 2, dyslexia strikes again, times k. And so we have here nk log 2 is the entropy of the system when there's no magnetic energy or the temperature is infinite. Each all states of the system are equally likely to occur. But as I crank up the magnetic field, and it happens again when beta mu h is of the order of 1, then it does something that looks like this. So this is somewhere around here, beta mu h of the order of 1. And at either low temperature or a very high magnetic field, all the spins are aligned and there's only one state available to the system and the entropy goes to 0. And so that's the basic thermodynamic properties of the paramagnet. Now, one other thing before I finish this example though, is that especially if you're an experimentalist, what one tends to look at is not the magnetization or the entropy, because first of all, how do you measure the entropy? I don't know how to measure it. I don't think anyone knows how to measure it. And also measuring the magnetization is not terribly easy. And so what people do to try and understand the thermodynamics of these systems is measure what are called response functions, which is how does the magnetization change when I tickle the system, or how does the entropy change when I tickle the system? What I mean by tickle the system, in the case of the magnetization, I imagine turning on a magnetic field which pushes the system towards a magnetized state, and I ask, how much bang do I get for the buck? And that's why it's called a response function. And so let me figure out how to order my blackboards now. Let's put this one here. Whoops, this is the back one. So put this here. And put this one here. Okay. So what I'm interested in now is how does the magnetic system respond to an external perturbation? And in the case of the magnetization, that is quantified by something called the isothermal susceptibility. So let me define pi, isothermal susceptibility, which is how susceptible is the system to changing the magnetic field. And so this is defined as dm by dh at constant temperature, if I want to be really pedantic about it.
Sorry, this might be a really silly question, but what's the etymology of like isothermal, and how does it relate to like magnetism? Because there's no magnet part of that word.
No, but isothermal means you're doing it under isothermal conditions, that you're keeping the temperature fixed. So you'll see, because in elementary thermodynamics, you learn there are two types of processes when you're squishing a gas. There's adiabatic processes where you're doing it at constant heat, and isothermal processes. And so this happens to be defined at isothermal. But anyways, so that's the etymology as best as I know. Okay. Anyways, so let's just differentiate this thing. So what we're going to get here, so when I differentiate the tanh, and again, this you have to reach back to elementary calculus. And so this is going to be n mu times beta mu h hyperbolic secant squared of beta mu h. So that is the isothermal susceptibility. And so again, let's try and learn what we can from this. And so in this particular case, again, I'm going to take a more experimental perspective, which is I'm going to now plot this versus temperature, because the average experimentalist says, I don't want to, there's three parameters there. Let's just do something which I can measure in my lab, which is my temperature. So let's look at the susceptibility as a function of the temperature. So first point, I can't differentiate properly. When I differentiate with respect to h, I don't bring an h out in front. So anyways, notice here that at h equals 0, secant squared of 0, which is 1 over the cosh, and 0 is 1. So this goes away. And all I have is 1 over beta. So for 0 magnetic field, I'll get something that looks like this, h equals 0. So the system becomes more susceptible as you lower the temperature. And this makes perfect sense because if you have a magnetic, you know, you have your spins and you lower the temperature, that means there's not a lot of thermal agitation. So I turn on a tiny little magnetic field that says point up. Well, there's no thermal agitation that's saying point down. It's just it's very quiet. And so the spins will respond very readily. And so the isothermal susceptibility diverges as t goes to zero if there's no magnetic field. On the other hand, if there's a non-zero magnetic field, then this thing, as temperature goes to zero, that means a beta goes to infinity, and C can't, you know, for a finite magnetic field, this thing will eventually blow up. And secant of that argument will go to zero. And so for H not equal to zero, it'll do something like this, and then it'll suddenly do something like that. So this is for H not equal to zero. And the point where there's a maximum of the susceptibility is, again, where beta mu H is of the order of one. And so if you do an undergraduate lab in physics, you may actually do this experiment of measuring the magnetic susceptibility of a paramagnet. And you know, the goal is to first of all see the fact that there's a maximum, and as you change the magnetic field, the location of the maximum scales with the magnetic field in this way.
Wait, sorry. So what we're plotting is not
We're plotting the magnetic the isothermal susceptibility, chi.
But we're plotting it with respect to
temperature. That's right.
If it's isothermal, isn't it constant temperature?
Yeah, but so at any particular temperature, I do the measurement, isothermal measurement, and yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So the main point here is that a magnetic system gets progressively more ticklish as you get to lower and lower temperature, but it's balanced by the magnetic field. So if the magnetic field is zero, the system becomes progressively more ticklish, but eventually, when the magnetic energy beats out the thermal energy, then you're not so ticklish anymore. And that's the behavior of the susceptibility. And then the other response function is the heat capacity. And so this heat capacity is a constant magnetic field. Again, trying to keep my thermodynamic variables kosher. And so this is the change, the heat added as a function of the temperature. A constant magnetic field. So this is equal to T dS by dT at constant magnetic field. And so if you just take my entropy that I wrote over there, let me just I'm not going to, I'll screw it up if I try and do the calculation. So this turns out to be NK beta mu H squared secant squared of beta mu h, hyperbolic secant. And again, if you plot as a function of temperature this heat capacity, first of all, what is the meaning of heat capacity? I mean, it means like how much heat the system can hold when you, maybe another way of putting it is like how much does the temperature of a system change when I add a certain amount of heat to the system? And by the way, you know, for those of you who do care about high energy physics, you know, the typical high energy physics experiment, they do calorimetry. They essentially measure the heat capacity in these experiments. And so like back in the 1700s and 1800s, when we had accelerators that were like of the order of EVs, like a candle, you know, that's, or like or a flame or something like that. And one was measuring calorimetry, one was looking at sort of at the atomic level. And now that we have like 10 to the 12th more energy, instead of looking at the atomic level, we're looking at the quark level. But calorimetry is a way of trying to probe the internal degrees of freedom of any kind of a system. And so in the case of our paramagnet, let's just look first of all at infinite temperature. So if the temperature is really high, that means that the spins are like, they're equally likely going between plus and minus. And so if I change a temperature from like a million degrees to a million degrees 0.1, the system, you're barely going to see any difference. So it's clear that way out here, the heat capacity should be very small. Similarly, if the temperature is really low, then, you know, the spins will be aligned with the magnetic field. And if the temperature is like you know, 0.01 Kelvin, and then you raise it to 0.02 Kelvin, not much is going to happen. So over here, also the heat capacity is small. But when the delta T is such that it matches the magnetic energy, that's the place where the system is most ticklish or the most susceptible to like heating up the system. If the amount of energy that you put into the system kind of matches the energy gap between spin up and spin down, then you can expect a big response. So again, there is some kind of a response that looks like this, and not a surprise that the peak is going to happen when beta mu h is of the order of 1. And so that is, the thermodynamics of this ideal system. So I guess what I would say is, you know, in undergraduate stat mech courses, we look at things like the ideal gas, the paramagnet, other types of simple ideal systems, and the way that you calculate its thermodynamics, you start with the partition function, you evaluate it, you compute the free energy, you compute various observables by appropriate derivatives, one computes response functions by second derivatives. And so this is the kind of program, if I was to give a homework problem and like find the thermodynamics of the ideal gas, you would just follow this program and you would end up with your answers. And so this is sort of like a whirlwind tour of thermodynamics, modulo my screw up over here with like what's going on there. And so what I want to do now in the remaining 10 minutes is I just want to give kind of a qualitative introduction to the next part of the course, which is interacting systems, interacting spin systems in particular. So all of this was predicated on the fact that you have, it's like what Ronald Reagan said about redwood trees. You've seen one redwood tree, you've seen them all. Similarly here, if you understand the properties of one particle, then you understand the properties of an n particle system. But what happens if particles are actually interacting? And one of the major results of 20th century statistical physics was understanding the properties of interacting systems. And the archetypical example of this is the Ising model, which was introduced in 1926. Wilhelm Lenz suggested to his thesis student, Ernst Ising, solve the one-dimensional Ising model, which he did because he was a good student of statistical mechanics. And he found that there was no phase transition. By the way, if you don't know what, does everyone know what the Ising model is? Okay. So anyways, he found there was no phase transition. And basically, he became a high school physics teacher or junior college physics teacher and left the world. And so even though he's probably one of the most famous names in physics and statistical physics, he basically left the field. And by the way, his story, if you want to know, it's kind of sad because he was married to a Jewish woman, and he was in Germany in the 1930s, and he was able to get out of Germany and not have to face the Holocaust. But when I was a graduate student, my instructor was Kirsten Wong, and maybe some of you know the book Kirsten Wong, Statistical Physics. It's one of the standard textbooks. And Kirsten Wong is a very entertaining guy who always told stories. And so one of his stories was he was camping somewhere in the Midwest, and he was next to a very tall, skinny guy, and they started talking. And so what do you do? Well, I'm a professor at MIT, and I teach physics. And what do you do? Well, I teach at a junior college. And you know, my name is Kirsten Wong, and what's your name? And his guy says, my name is Ernst Ising. So anyway, it was kind of, and I guess the other thing is that everybody calls it the Ising model, which is a mispronunciation, so that even though Ernst Ising is really famous, like nature has a way of getting back at him because everybody mispronounces its name. Okay, so I'm just going to draw a picture for the last few minutes. Whoa.
That happens all the time.
Oh, it happens all the time? Oh, okay. So now I'm going to talk about interacting spin systems. And again, my prototypical example is the Ising model. And so the Hamiltonian of the Ising model is normally written as minus J summation over two. So here the indices ij refer to neighboring spins sigma I, sigma j, where here sigma I can be either plus or minus one. And that's the model. And so this is now interacting because the state of one spin depends on its neighbors. And so there's a couple of important assumptions about this easing model, which is, first of all, two state spins. So this is a huge approximation, because if you actually do like the quantum mechanics of ferromagnetism, it's very complicated. And there's not just two states, there's many states, and there's all kinds of embellishments on this basic model. But the point is that if we're interested in only the collective behavior of a system, it turns out that if you have more spin states, or they're not necessarily pointing in, you know, there's, if you have more than two spin states, it doesn't change qualitatively the behavior of the transition from no order, from disorder to order. And so let's just deal with the simplest case. The two state spins. One is at its nearest neighbor interactions. And in honor of the fact that I'm in my home country, I'll spell this Canadian way, nearest neighbor interactions. No disorder. So these are drastic assumptions, because reality is that, you know, interactions fall off as some function of the distance between spins that are distant, some distance away. But also, this is actually was a very vibrant area, which is understanding the role of longer range interactions. So it has been elucidated that as long as the interactions are short range, namely fall off faster than a power law in distance with a specific exponent, then you don't have to worry about the fact that the long range interactions do anything. And in fact, this is kind of in the renormalization group perspective. It's just that all short range Hamiltonians are in the same universality class. And no disorder means that every interaction is exactly the same. So this number j here, which measures the interaction energy between two spins I and j, is the same for every possible spin. And again, people have looked at the disordered Ising model. And you know, if when the disorder is weak, one understands like what are the conditions for when the disorder can be ignored. And for the cases that we're interested in, the disorder can be ignored. And so, you know, many generations of graduate students have heard the speech, you know, from like people like me, you know, like looking reverentially at this model, because it's so simple, any kid can understand it. But if you want a Nobel Prize, solve for the partition function of the 3D Ising model. I guarantee you will win the Nobel Prize, because the guy who solved the two-dimensional Ising model did win the Nobel Prize, and that was Lars Onsager. And if you delve into the details of the solution of the two-dimensional Ising model, it's incredibly beautiful, incredibly detailed, and very sophisticated. And you know, we have some belief now that maybe it's not possible with the mathematics that we know now to solve the 3D case. So if you can solve it, more power to you. You know, you will get your 930,000 kroners or whatever it is for the Nobel Prize. Anyways. But let's just be a little bit more modest here. And let me just, I've got three more minutes to go. Let me just sort of outline like what we see for this type of an Ising model. So the normal phase diagram is temperature going this way, magnetic field going this way. And there is something called the critical point, TC. And at the critical point, there is what's called a second order phase transition. Second order means that the magnetization of the system goes starts out zero out here and continuously rises at TC and becomes plus or minus one as the temperature goes to zero. And you know, again, for people who do the renormalization group and all this kind of stuff, there's a lot of effort in understanding the physical properties at the critical point. And it's very beautiful and it's very sophisticated, but it's also just one point in the phase diagram. So my perspective as well, yes, all the renormalization group is very beautiful and very powerful, but only one point in the phase diagram, why not care about everything else? And so here, there is a first order phase transition line. So up here, the magnetization is pointing, say, parallel to the field. here it's pointing down. It's always parallel to the field, but as the field goes from positive to negative, so there's spin up, spin down phase. And if I go across this line as I change the magnetic field, there'll be a jump in the magnetization. So if I'm plotting, say, along a line like this, I'm going to plot magnetization as a function of magnetic field. It points in one direction, and then it does something like this. And this jump in the magnetization gets smaller and smaller until I get to the critical point, where right at here, the magnetization as a function of magnetic field will do something like this. I'm in with infinite slope. And so this is, again, this is magnetization as a function of magnetic field. Magnetization as a function of magnetic field. This is for t less than tc. This is at t equals tc. And above the critical temperature, the magnetization varies smoothly and analytically, and so there's nothing really to discuss. It's basically like the paramagnet. So what I'm going to do next time is discuss a little bit more about the physical properties of the Ising model and discuss its mean field solution, its one-dimensional solution, and then its dimensional dependent behavior. And finally, I will talk a little bit about universality, scaling, the renormalization group. But I'm going to do a very bare bones approach to this because, as you will learn, especially if you're going to take a course in quantum field theory, that there's very sophisticated methods that one develops to try and to develop renormalization techniques. But the principle underlying it is actually very simple. So I wanted to show you the absolute simplest way to appreciate renormalization in the framework of the simplest model. So I guess that's it for today. And I apologize for my screw up early on. I'll try and fix that for next time. And I'll see you, I guess, tomorrow, right? OK, thank you.